of world dominance. But to look at the details, next please, of this, just to give you, again, the workroom section, ceiling. Remember, Hitler was not a terribly large person. Next, please. And then the seating area at the other end of this space with its overstuffed furniture and its shaded lamps and so on. And then perhaps a final view. Next, please, a detail of one of the wall panels in the Reichskanzlei, showing you here these the actual sculptural elements within these frameworks as an example of things that were repeated ad nauseum. Now, the Reichskanzlei, the governmental center for the Reich, was matched by other public buildings at a large scale. Remember Hitler emphasizing public buildings. Next, please. Here, for example, is a model of the Supreme Army Command in Berlin, built by Wilhelm Kreis in 1938. And again, you see the same kind of architectural language that we've been looking at, the same kind of large-scale planning. And if you go inside, next please, you also see things like this, which was the soldiers' hall inside this undertaking. In other words, a place of assembly pitched at an inordinately large scale, mirroring in many ways some quality, almost in a subterranean sense, of the great Roman baths. The public buildings also included things like, next please, the Olympic Stadium, built in 1936, which was also mentioned this morning, and where Thomas Wolfe watched the Olympics in 1936 and wrote about it very enthusiastically, and where Jesse Owings ran. So Wolfe was amazed by the industry and ability to organize that produced a stadium that could carry or house 100,000 people. Next, please. And he apparently was favorably impressed by walking down these passageways that distributed this vast amount, number of people throughout the stadium for the different events. Also pitched on a huge scale, next please, were the great monuments that were, or great in quotation marks, that were arranged for by and for the Nazis. For example, this setup here is in Annaberg. It's a monument for the Freikorps movement and was put up in the 30s, in the mid-30s, and includes a place for meetings as well as the memorial up on the hill. Well, what I've been showing you so far all seems to be out of one mold, and at best to be a set of variations on a monstrous theme. But in fact, there was an awful lot of other kinds of architecture promoted by the Nazis. And to give you an idea of how that might work, I want to turn to an extreme contrast, which is what they did with industrial building. Next, please. If we look at the Opel factory, for example, on the screen now, by a certain Heinrich Bersch, we are very much very much considering a building that seems to come out of the discipline of the modern architecture that the Nazis had so vehemently rejected. The whole building has a sense of volume about it, large strip windows that reveal that this is a steel frame building with a curtain wall, no ornament, light materials, giving the impression of having come out of an industrial age. In fact, one would be hard pressed to distinguish this particular undertaking, next please, from this factory, of which you see in a model here, which is by Mies van der Rohe and produced in 1936-7 for the Krefeld Silk Works. In other words, in terms of industrial building, there seems to have been a easy acceptance of the kind of architectural attitudes which were directly derived from the tradition of modern architecture, from the interest in factory building from before the First World War to the translation of that aesthetic into structures such as you see here. And clearly the Nazis were proud of these buildings. Next, please. For example, Emil Fahrenkamp's IG Farben power plant with, as they refer to it, without a smokestack. Of course, it's hidden in there, but that's the idea of this large glass curtain wall without the obvious presence of a smokestack was what interested Nazis, and this is how they published this work. Or one might look at this factory in Westphalia, next please, which begins to monumentalize this type of industrial architecture in such a way that one almost thinks of a scene setting for Metropolis, the Fritz Lang movie, upon looking at it. Here, the factory smokestack is monumentalized rather than hidden away. But in terms of how the wall is treated and the buildings generally, it follows also in the line of a modern architectural aesthetic. The industrial buildings, next please, might also assume some of the apparatus of the party. For example, in this factory, you see that the flag stanchions are incorporated as part of the design, so that that kind of flags and light show could be part of the industrial building. But the building itself has very much that clean, austere quality that we are used to in terms of modern architecture. So it's easy to, so having looked at work like this, it would be easy to say, okay, for industrial buildings, the Nazis turned to this kind of work, this kind of architecture. But that was not universally so, because there was also used a kind of what I might refer to as vernacular industrial for some of their buildings. Next, please. Which you see in this curious little operation. It's an Air Force weather station with all kinds of high-tech apparatus, as you can see, which is put into a building with thatched roofs and made out of wood, so presumably that it would blend into the landscape. And one might say, well, there's a reason for that, or perhaps a reason that is to provide camouflage for this building. But in fact, it introduces a yet another theme for architecture under the Nazis, and that was the quality of the vernacular that informed many of its enterprises. And one sees that especially vividly in the Ordensburgen, in these training schools for the Nazi leadership elite. Next, please. I show you, for example, here, Vogelsang in the Eiffel, which is up there, built in from the early 30s on, and characterized by the Nazis in this somewhat Wagnerian sense. These buildings, they said, stand entirely alone and proudly command the landscape, like knightly strongholds of old, the medieval reference again. In symmetry and proportion, they are severe, manly, and monumental. And if we see not only this view, this distant view of the Ordensburg in the Eiffel, sort of commanding it and yet part of it, but published by the Nazis, but also go into the Ordensburg, next please, and look out from it into the valley covered with fog, you get the sense of a kind of Richard Wagner stage operatic set, which is very much part of the mentality that determines this sort of thing. Now, another of these Ordensburg, may I have the next please, indicate that these were vast buildings again, but vast buildings done within the mode of a vernacular architecture, a kind of folky tradition of wood and pitched roofs, sometimes thatch, natural building materials, low to the land, and so on. So that, rather than using either that classical reductive language or the industrial modern architecture language, here a totally different one is observed. This was especially promoted in the context of the Hitler Youth hostels, which we also heard about this morning, that issue of turning to the youth. And I'll show you three of these hostels in different parts of Germany. Next, please. This one is in Urfeld. And the argument behind these youth hostels were that the buildings were supposed to be done in the mode of the vernacular architecture of the region, so that the youth going from one to one or traveling and over a period of time visiting these different hostels would have a sense of identity with the region, of its particularities, and of how that particular local culture actually lived. So you see one youth hostel like this, natural stone and wood, pitched roofs and so on. Next, please. Or this one in Berthe's Gardens, presumably representing the, or in the image of the local architecture there. Next, please. Or this one in Titizay, which shows these cantilevered, a building with these cantilevered upper story, and again, the steeply pitched roofs and so on. Now, it's interesting to also recognize that although we think of Hitler in terms of a public architecture and large-scale planning, he was quite simpatico to this kind of thing. For example, next please, if we look at the interior of his house in Ober-Salzburg, although again it's pitched on a gigantic scale, if you look at it, you'll see it has the same kind of homey vernacular quality as did these youth hostels. It's presumably in places like this that he watched King Kong. Next, please. This approach was also applied to utilitarian buildings that served the landscape. This, for example, is a new farm in Mecklenburg. And the Nazi architects talk about the problem of having to, or the challenge, really, of taking a modern agricultural establishment with its machinery and technology and trying to put it into the traditional architecture of that region, which they have done here with its Fachwerk, its pitched roof, and so on. Now, looking at a view like this reminds one of things somewhat medieval. In any case, these are buildings derived from centuries past, and there was a strong connection that the Nazis had to the medieval past. Next, please. They, in fact, celebrated it, as you see here. This is not a stage set, and it's not really original construction anymore. It's a small part of the center of medieval Frankfurt, as it was fixed up, saniert, and restored by the Nazis in 1937-38, with its Fachwerkhaus, its pitched roofs, its irregular disposition of parts, its open spaces that are rather contained, and so on. And it's in this context, this medievalizing context, that I want to turn to one of the last of these different kinds of approaches to architecture pursued by the Nazis, and that is their sense of both what the house was and how the house should be organized into larger settlements. Next, please. Now, the house was to be a kind of reductivist version of the medieval house, as you see it here. It became small white cubes of great simplicity with steeply pitched red roofs put into larger collections of housing. And you see a detail of such an undertaking as this. But the larger collection of these buildings was to happen in the context of a new town, new settlements for this new race. And the ideology of that new town was derived from observations about the medieval German city, almost a literal translation of a description of a medieval German city applied to the idea of the new Aryan community. Next, please. So I'm going to do something strange. I'm going to show you a plan and then a view of a real medieval German city, Nördlingen. And then I'm going to give you an idea of how the Nazis wanted to make their own new communities. And I think you will see the direct relationship between this medieval past and the Nazi variation on it. the new town, that is this new settlement where those little houses were to go, was to have about 20,000 inhabitants. This was a size that was calculated to avoid the disadvantages of both metropolis and village, and at the same time to include the advantages of both village and city. And that sounds an awful lot like the major arguing point for the Garden City, a reform movement that was established around the turn of the century in England and had a major impact in Germany. There were to be two traffic axes, one primarily east-west, the second one north-south. And these would be fixed up in the Nazi towns so that what you see here in outline would be more or suggested here in Nordlingen would be more vividly presented in the new town. And these two axes would constitute the framework of the new town. The crossing was to be the political center of the town, as in the medieval town it had been the location for the major church. And here the government buildings were to stand. Industry, public utilities, and passage and freight railroad stations were to be laid out to the east, because the predominant winds in Germany would then push the noise and the smoke away from the town. Sport facilities, parade plazas, hospital, and cemetery to the west. Housing sectors were to be located between the arms of the cross, of that cross axis, and a subsistence zone was to be drawn up around each city to support it agriculturally and to serve as a market for the goods it produced. Three-dimensionally, next please, and here is a view now of Nördlingen, an air view of Nördlingen. Three-dimensionally, the new town was supposed to be a very squat cone with a wide circular base. Buildings were to take their size and site and shape in the hierarchy from the periphery to the center according to the significance of community life. This was what the Nazis referred to as Bausozialismus, the law of political building order. A stepped relationship of buildings that would express the relationship between leader and the led within the community. For the purpose of the elements of each section of the city were to be oriented toward the center. The center in turn would lead to the next highest one in a hierarchy of cities, and so on until one had moved from the city to the major city in Berlin and thus orchestrated all of life. Now, another way, next please, in which this life was to be orchestrated was by means of transportation. And transportation is the last of these elements that I wish to discuss today. Transportation would break down the sectionalism that had been rampant in Germany, and thus the airport became important. This is the design for Tempelhof in Berlin. And what also became important, next please, was the building of the Reichsautobahn, which was supposed to be driven on by the people's car, the Volkswagen, which didn't yet exist. But the Autobahn was built everywhere, and again, the structures on it and how it was orchestrated as a roadway in the landscape was supposed to be adjusted to the characteristics of the region, visual characteristics of the region. In other words, not simply to slash through the landscape. Now, having very rapidly run through this plurality of building, I would like to make a few comments of summary about Nazi architecture. May I have the next, please? And I'm showing you the Nuremberg Congress Hall under construction as a backdrop for some of these comments. It is a tendency in the literature of the last decade on Nazi architecture to attempt to view it neutrally. That is simply to say this was what was done, this was why it was done, according to the ideas that were presented by the Nazis themselves. That means there is no critical position or evaluation that is applied to these buildings. From that neutral stance, one has now moved to where some of the ideas inherent in this architecture are being proposed as or advocated as the basis, or as a possible base for new work. So that the poverty of design in this work and the fact that it carried an ideology which is of which you've been talking about extensively at this conference and which of course is extremely suspect, is not brought into the equation in terms of evaluating this work. And thus, next please, we can produce things like this, which is the new State of Illinois Center by Helmut Jahn, just completed in Chicago, which follows the same argument of large-scale reductive formalism that we saw the Nazis working with, including such strange things as slicing off this large set of cylinders here because the street goes past and making that a formal statement, and presenting the building, this is a photograph produced by the Jahn firm, presenting the building in the context, interestingly, you just see it here. Can you shift that over a little bit, Sandra, just to, so we get that whole picture? You see what you see here is, in fact, a classical column, so that the visual presentation of the building is related to this symbol of classical antiquity. Its value is established, supposed value is established in that relationship. What has happened is that this structure is generated out of some kind of idea about marketing, which is applied to architecture. And what it does is lose here, as it did in the Nazi era, those things that in fact distinguish architecture. Next, please. And which I would like to say one, in a certain way, seems summed up in this interior, which is a view of the Kimball Museum by Louis Kahn, about a building now of about 20, 25 years. And where the rich exploration of architectural ideas is present, and one could examine an interior in this space and the relation between form and structure and architectural expression in great detail, but where also you have an architecture that can be monumental but humane at the same time, incorporate nature and provide a place for people to be, none of which really was achieved under the Nazi regime. Thank you.